ebooks! Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I shall be continuing my story of the Wars of the Roses, or the story of the whole of the English monarchy, British monarchy, ultimately, in the end. But we're talking about Henry the Sixth right now, aren't we? The son of Henry the Fifth, who's very, very weak and quite possibly suffering from genuine mental health problems, and that the Hundred Years' War has come to an ignominious end as far as the English are concerned, and that's morphing now into the Wars of the Roses, where the various cousin branches of the Plantagenets are starting to go to war with each other, particularly the House of York and the House of Lancaster, descended from the second and third son of John of Gaunt. I keep talking about the John of Gaunt and the Lionel, Duke of Clarence. And last time we got up to the Battle of St. Albans, which was really the first. It's almost a battle, not quite a big proper battle, but I think maybe if you were there, it would seem quite battle-like, but it wasn't a full-blown pitched battle out on the fields with thousands of men lining up and loads of massed archery units and a cavalry charge apiece and all that sort of thing. However, people did get killed in it. People definitely died, and the king changed hands. You know, the king that's a puppet, really. So that's where we got up to last time, where the Yorkist faction under Richard, Duke of York, and Warwick, the kingmaker, had just won the Battle of St. Albans, taken the king hostage, or they now controlled him one way or another. So the fortunes of the Lancastrians are at a low ebb at this point. Margaret of Anjou and all the various people in that orbit are at a low ebb. And if you remember last time, I talked about how the pendulum swings back and forth wildly during the Wars of the Roses. It really does. You know, when you look at big wars from the 20th century, quite often it becomes clear long before the end who's going to win, doesn't it? Well, that's not the case here. It wildly swings back and forth. So at this particular point, i.e. straight after the Battle of St. Albans, it's back in the Yorkist favour. And it's already swung, what, three or four times, hasn't it? Already. So we'll keep doing that. So once again, I should be reading from Sir Winston Churchill, The History of the English-Speaking Peoples, and The History of England by Professor Sir Charles Oman, one of the very, very best historians ever to have done it, an Oxford historian from the early 20th century, very late 19th century, early 20th century, whom Churchill seems to have drawn upon quite heavily. I want to read a little bit here from Churchill to sort of ease us into this episode, where he talks in a bit more general terms about things. So he says this, quote, "Historians have shrunk from the Wars of the Roses, and most of those who have catalogued their events have left us only a melancholy and disjointed picture. We are, however, in the presence of the most ferocious and implacable quarrel of which there is a factual record." In other words, he's saying, it's actually a complicated picture. The amount that it swings back and forth is crazy. The record isn't 100% complete, right? We're still in the 15th century, remember? It's still a very long time ago. And the record isn't 100% complete. You know, when you get up to the 18th, 19th, 20th century, it is an embarrassment of riches as far as a historian is concerned. There's far too much documentary evidence. There's too much. You could never get through it all, right? If you wanted to read everything that there was to read about World War One, say, it's not possible in a lifetime. All the papers across all of Europe or across all of the world, for a start, it would take a lifetime to read those, just that. Whereas, if you go back to the 15th century, if you talk about the Wars of the Roses, it's still completely incomplete. And so often, you don't know, we just don't know exactly what happened. You know, why did this alliance fall apart? Why is this person now suddenly switched camps or something like that, right? And there's so many characters, so many personages that are of some importance to keep track of them all, unless you're a professional historian and you spend a lifetime on this stuff. Again, it can get very, very confusing very, very quickly. That's why when I'm telling this story, I will keep it to just the key players and keep reminding you who's who, right? Hopefully I've put in your mind the idea that Richard, Duke of York, the father of Edward IV to be, Richard, Duke of York is like a Tywin Lannister character. He's like Charles Dance type figure. That's how I have him in mind. Maybe that will help you sort of anchor at least that character, you know? And you've got the super weak king and his evil wife. I was going to call her Margaret of Anjou evil. I mean, I don't know if she is particularly. She was called the Bad Queen or something like that, wasn't she? And it's easy to think of her as foreign and French and evil in some way. It's easy, but whether she really was, it's not quite that simple. But Churchill just saying here that it is a complicated story and there's no two ways about it. You know, if I have to keep mentioning the family tree, I have to keep mentioning that you've got Edward III and all his children and the second son, well, the first son, the Black Prince, who died, and then his son died or was killed, and then Lionel, Duke of Clarence, and the third son, John of Gaunt. I have to keep telling you that. And all those descendants. There's actually much more to it than that. The Mortimers and the Beauforts and so on and so on. So Churchill says, goes on to say here, the individual actors were bred by generations of privilege and war into which the feudal theme had brought its peculiar sense of honour and to which the papacy contributed such spiritual sanction as emerged from its rivalries and intrigues. It was a conflict in which personal hatreds reached their maximum and from which mass effects were happily excluded. Yeah, personal hatred reached their maximum. Just to let you know, towards the end of the Wars of the Roses, what quite often happened is one side would win a battle and they would, and any of the leadership on the other side that didn't die in the battle but were captured, they just all get executed because it's the only way to end a blood feud in a way. Right, the only way to end a blood feud is to just kill all the other side, kill them all. Now, that's brutal, even for the 15th century, in England anyway. Perhaps in the East, it's a bit different. But the idea that you would kill loads and loads of members of your own family, loads and loads of your own cousins, or all your own cousins, you'd kill them all. Well, you felt like you had to. That was the only way to sort of bring it to an end. So, yeah, it gets really bloody. And as Churchill said, their personal hatreds reach their maximum. We talked yesterday, didn't we, about that famous quote. That you killed my father and now I'm going to kill you and your father. That, you know, vendetta. It's the nature of vendetta. Churchill says, there must have been many similar convulsions in human history. None, however, has been preserved with characters at once so worldly and so expensively chiselled. Needless causes of confusion may be avoided. Towns must not be confused with titles. This is a good point he's about to make. The mortal struggle of York and Lancaster did not imply any antagonism between the two well-known English counties. Right, yeah, so the Yorkist family, their strongholds weren't necessarily up and around York, the city of York. And the Duchy of Lancaster, the family, the Lancastrian family, weren't necessarily all that strong in Lancaster. So, yeah, just be careful about that. York has, in fact, this is Churchill again, York was, in fact, the stronghold of the Lancastrians. And the Yorkists founded their strength upon the Midlands and the south of England. The ups and downs of fortune were so numerous and startling, the family feuds so complicated, the impact of national feeling in moments of crisis so difficult to measure, because of like the incomplete record, basically, that it has been the fashion to disparage this period. I think it's one of the most fascinating bits of English history in all, personally. Only Shakespeare, this is Churchill again, only Shakespeare, basing himself largely upon Hall's Chronicle, has portrayed its savage yet heroic lineaments. He does not attempt to draw conclusions, and for dramatic purposes, telescopes events and campaigns. Let us now set forth the facts as they occurred. And then Churchill picks up the story again from the Battle of St. Albans, saying this. St. Albans was the first shedding of blood in strife. Well, remember the story, not quite. I mean, maybe in something approaching a battle, but it's not the first blood, is it? Gloucester was murdered and Suffolk was murdered. So there has been blood. And you could draw all of this back to Henry IV, Henry the Bolingbroke's usurpation of Richard II. You know, that blood, whether he was just smothered or, whether he's actually murdered or not, we don't know. Whether he was just starved to death or smothered or something. But, you know, it's not really the first shedding of blood, but okay. The Battle of St. Albans. I guess what Churchill's saying is in some sort of open conflagration. He says, St. Albans was the first shedding of blood in strife. The Yorkist gained possession of the king. Yeah, they were able to take him into their power. And he's so weak and feeble that you can then claim that you're the, whether he signs off on it or not, you can just claim you're the government now. You've taken the king prisoner. That means you're the government now. Okay, sort of like that. But soon we see the inherent power of Lancaster, i.e. the faction that's just been defeated at the Battle of St. Albans, basically. They had the majority of the nobles on their side and the majesty of the crown, because the king, even though being taken prisoner, hostage by the Yorkists, he is a Lancastrian though, isn't he? Right? So nothing will change that. In a few months, they, the Lancastrians, were as strong as ever. Continual trials of strength were made. There were risings in the country and grim assemblies of Parliament. Legality, constitutionalism, and reverence for the crown were countered, but not yet overthrown, by turbulent and bloody episodes. The 4 years from 1456 to 1459 were a period of uneasy truce. All seemed conscious of the peril to themselves and to their order, but fate lay heavy upon them. There were intense efforts at reconciliation. The spectacle was displayed to the Londoners of the king being escorted to Westminster by a procession in which the Duke of York and Queen Margaret walked side by side. Arch enemies, remember? The Duke of York have got the blood royal. If the king, and now his little baby Edward, if they were to die, he would just be the king. He's literally the next in line to the throne. Margaret of Anjou knows that. And so they're just arch enemies. The Duke of York, Richard Duke of York and Margaret of Anjou would kill each other if they could, right? So it's okay. But they walked side by side, followed by the Yorkist and Lancastrian lords, the most opposed in pairs, you know, trying to heal this rift. Solemn pledges of amity were exchanged. The sacrament was taken in common by all the leaders. You know, they're all Catholics still. The Reformation hasn't happened yet. So they're all still good Catholics. The sacrament was taken in common by all the leaders. All sought peace where there was no peace. It's a type of thing, you know, it's just simmering under the surface. You know, nothing has truly been resolved. Everyone's still got their ambitions and their grudges. Even when a kind of settlement was reached in London, it was upset by violence in the north. In 1459, fighting broke out again. A gathering near Worcester of armed Yorkists dispersed in the presence of the royal army and their chiefs scattered. York returned to Ireland, Richard Duke of York, returned to Ireland and Warwick to his captaincy of Calais, in which he had succeeded Somerset. End quote. Somerset, who was killed at the Battle of St. Albans, remember. Okay, let's go over to Sir Charles Omar and let him tell us about this period, see how he describes it. Slightly differently. Okay, so Charles Omar, at the very beginning of the 20th century, wrote this, quote, "The first Battle of St. Albans put the control of the king's person into the hands of York, who again assumed the management of the realm, but he only kept it for less than a year." So the pendulum swings back within a year. "In 1456, the king asserted his constitutional power of changing his ministers." He suddenly grew a pair of balls out of nowhere. Decided to start doing the business of government, except he didn't. It was the people around him who controlled him, really. Margaret of Anjou's faction and lots of various other very, very powerful magnates. But on paper, the king asserted his constitutional power of changing his ministers and turned Duke Richard's friends out of office. As his foe Somerset was now dead, Richard Duke of York's foe Somerset was now dead, York was fairly contented to leave matters in the king's own control. But after the bloodshed at St. Albans, there could be no true reconciliation between the friends of the king and the friends of York. The fierce and active young Queen Margaret put herself at the head of the party which Suffolk and Somerset had formerly led. She feared for her infant son's right of succession to the throne and was determined to crush York to make his path clear. Because again, should the mentally ill king, Henry VI, should he die, for whatever reason, then the crown will either pass to his tiny little son, an Edward, that we're talking about here, little baby son, Edward, or Richard Duke of York, right? The legit heir would be the little baby, but you know how things go in a martial age. It's relatively easy just to make a baby disappear or an infant if you really wanted to. If an entire kingdom or realm was at stake, you only need to make one infant disappear and you're a badass dude like Richard Duke of York, been in all sorts of wars in France and in Ireland, and even like members of your own family and things have already been killed and murdered and you're already in a blood feud of some type, right? You can see why Margaret of Anjou might fear for her position and that of her little baby. Because it's not that far away from some sort of situation where, well, she's one heartbeat away, the king's heartbeat, away from being in a position where Richard Duke of York will just kill her baby and maybe her. So you can see why, even though Richard Duke of York at this stage has shown no real interest in doing something like that. He's very, very clement, if anything, for the 15th century. But nonetheless, you could see why Margaret of Anjou would be paranoid. Except that's what I'm saying. It's not really paranoia. It's sort of a reasonable fear, a reasonable worry. Okay, so because of that worry, she's determined to crush York to make her baby's path clear to the throne. Throughout the years 1457 to 58, while a precarious peace was still preserved, Margaret was journeying up and down the land, enlisting partisans in her cause and giving them her son's badge of the White Swan to wear in token of promised fidelity. So while there's a bit of peace between them, both sides are still really marshalling their forces and, you know, getting ready for if and when, more likely when, hostilities break out again. And livery has a fair bit to do with all of this, i.e. what you wear. So if you wear a certain badge, the red or the white rose, or in this case, the white swan, letting the world know which side you're on, heraldry and livery. Okay, Oman continues saying this. The inevitable renewal of war came in 1459. Its immediate cause was an attempt by some of the Queen's retainers to slay the young Earl of Warwick. Warwick being a staunch Yorkist. That's one of the things you should have pinned in your mind, that you've got Richard, Duke of York. He's got three sons, the sons in splendour, these sons of York. And Warwick. So in the Yorkist party, you've got Tywin Lannister, Charles Dance. He's got three sons and Warwick. Warwick the Kingmaker. He's really, really super important to this whole story. Warwick. And the Queen tried to slay him, or her retainers did. Oman describes the young Earl of Warwick as York's ablest and most energetic supporter. Then Salisbury, Warwick's father, raised his Yorkshire tenants in arms. The Queen sent against them a force under Lord Audley, whom the elder Neville defeated and slew at Blawhith. After this skirmish, all England flew to arms to aid one party or the other. York, Salisbury and Warwick met in Ludlow on the Welsh border, while the king gathered a great army at Worcester, taking the field himself. Remember, it's just, you know, the king is a puppet. The fact that he took the field himself. It's not like Henry V taking the field. It's not like Edward I or Edward III taking the field. He's just a figurehead. But okay, he himself took the field with a vigour which he never before or afterwards displayed. He didn't get involved in any sort of swordplay like his father, Henry V. Henry V literally involved in melee fighting, hand-to-hand combat, at Agincourt. Henry VI not doing any such thing, of course. Oman continues, saying, it seems that York's adherents were moved by the vehement appeals which King Henry made to their loyalty, and cowed by the superior forces that he mustered. At the rout of Ludlow, they broke up without fighting, leaving their leaders to escape as best they might. York fled to Ireland, Salisbury and Warwick to Calais, of which the younger Neville, Warwick, was governor. So, again, the pendulum swings. Now the Lancastrians are at a super high ebb. The entire Yorkist party is dispersed, fled in ignominy. The king and his party of Lancastrians, complete victory, Oman goes on. But the surprising and sudden vicissitudes of fortune, that's a classic Edward Gibbon turn of phrase there, the vicissitudes of fortune, i.e. the pendulum swinging back and forth, the vicissitudes of fortune were the order of the day all through the Wars of the Roses. The Queen and her friends ruled harshly and unwisely after they had driven York out of the land. They assembled a parliament at Coventry, which dealt out hard measures of attainder and confiscation against all who had favoured Duke Richard. I.e. Margaret of Anjou realises, you know, it's a complete victory, Lancastrian victory. So she's just going to, well, she clamped down too harshly, really, in hindsight. It's either kill all your enemies like a Turkish sultan, murder every single last one of them and all their kin, or be extremely kind and forgiving and put massive amounts of effort into reconciliation. But to do a halfway house, I.e. you're quite strict on them, you're quite harsh on them, but you're not going the full-bore nuclear option. Well, it doesn't work out well. Let's continue reading here. Okay, bills of attainder and confiscation against all who have favoured Duke Richard. They sacked the open town of Newbury because it was supposed to favour York, and hung seven citizens of London of the Duke's party. These cruel actions turned the heart of the nation from the king and the ruthless Queen Margaret. Just the optics of it don't look good. And you're not strong enough to do the nuclear option, you know, to do the Mongol option, the Scipio option of forcing an entire country to your will, regardless of how ruthless or brutal it is. They're not capable of that. They're not even really trying to do that. So the halfway house of just, you know, just executing seven people here, sacking a town there, confiscating the property and estates of a small number of people here or there. Yeah, the politics, the optics of that just turned the country against them. Well, some of the country, half the country anyway. It's the nature of a civil war, Oman continues. Hearing of this state of affairs, Warwick and Salisbury suddenly made a descent from Calais, i.e. that the country had turned against Margaret and the king. So, you know, the Nevilles, Warwick decides, oh, maybe we could just bounce back across the channel, try our luck again. And they landed at Sandwich and pushed boldly inland. The whole of Kent rose to join them, and they were able to march on London. That pendulum swinging again. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.